Falling. Falling in love. Falling into a fit of righteous rage. Falling and breaking a leg. I had spent most of my life falling. The problem with a fall, of course, is that somehow it implies a kind of out-of-controlledness. Is that a word? Anyway, the strange thing is that I've never thought of myself as being out of control. Except the breaking my leg thing. That was stairs made slippery by the San Francisco liquid sunshine, a.k.a. heavy morning fog. Metaphorically speaking, however, I've always liked falling. That exhalation before surrendering to the shimmering abyss. The sensuous somersaults in midair. The whoosh and swirl of the whirlwind around my body. To me, falling is breath-rushing delight, connecting me with all the other souls who seem as exhilarated by the fall as myself. No, it's never the falling that's the trouble. It's the end of the fall that always seems to be the problem.
Good evening and welcome to A Novel Idea. This is your host, Rosemary Manchester. You've been listening to a reading from One of Another, a new novel by Lizanne Bassam. And Lizanne is in the studio to talk with me about her book, One of Another. Welcome back, Lizanne.
Thank you, Rosemary. It's really nice to be back here.
Yeah, many of you will remember that Lizanne did a short piece with us just before the book festival to talk about the festival. And I was so interested in her book that I wanted a whole hour of her time. So I asked her if she wouldn't come back and talk with us at some length about One of Another. It's your second novel, Lizanne. The first one was Barefoot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One of Another is not a memoir, as you specify on the cover. One of Another takes place in San Francisco, and you live there, Lizanne, in the Castro District while a student at San Francisco State. Is that right?
Close. I was at San Francisco State in the late 70s and early 80s when everyone was getting AIDS.
Yes.
And then I went away to graduate school over in Berkeley, and then I came back and lived in the Castro as people started dying.
It's a very unusual experience, certainly not one that you sought, but to be present at the beginning of something so earth-shaking as the AIDS epidemic.
Yeah, it was like I left a party and came back to a funeral.
Oh, my goodness. And that was an interval of
3 years.
3 years. Things changed so
very
completely.
Very dramatically, yeah.
And, well, then you were there watching the tragedy unfold.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah, I lived in the Castro for 2 years before I moved up to Sonoma County, and Sonoma County was also experiencing the same.
When did you decide to write this novel about life during the AIDS epidemic?
I started working on it in 2002, actually. The first draft of it came fairly quickly, and I didn't decide to write a novel. It just started writing itself, and then I sat on it for a while before really going back and doing the hard work of the editing process after that first rush of a creative draft.
I think that interval between the event itself and the urge to write about it is the secret of being able to write about it. If you leap into it immediately, it just doesn't work. You don't have the perspective.
Yeah, it would have been way too close. Mm-hmm. It would have been way too close.
I've heard people say that about the events of September 11th, 2001, that the urge was immediately to write. But the people who did write immediately found that they weren't saying what they really wanted. They didn't know really what they wanted to say.
Yeah.
And I think that as the years pass, more and more people are starting to write about it coherently.
Well, I think it's really interesting, right? You know, now is the anniversary of Harvey Milk's death.
Oh, yes.
And the movie, the Sean Penn movie, is about to come out. And I think it's interesting because there seems to be a resurgence of understanding, and obviously with what's been going on politically. I don't know, it just seems like a very interesting time to revisit that world, which was a kind of a unique little bubble for a while.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then it took over the universe, as it were. And then I wasn't in this part of the country when all these things happened. So I'm really glad that you and other people have written about them in a way that I can get a feeling for what it was like to be there.
Oh, thank you.
And I think even people who were in this part of the country might have missed it during those early days because it was right on your doorstep. You couldn't help but know about it.
Right.
Yeah. We've just celebrated, well, I don't know if celebrated is the right term. We've just observed World AIDS Day on the 1st of December. And all over the world, particular attention has been paid to the AIDS epidemic, which was one of the reasons I particularly wanted to do this show with you in December, because as we move into a time of holidays and festivities, I think it's good to remember the other events of the world and the real crisis in other parts of the world. People seem to think that there's no longer a problem with AIDS, and you certainly know that that's not true.
Right. There are whole villages in Africa where children, you know, there's just whole villages of orphans.
Yes.
And in this country, people who have been living with the medication now for 20 and 30 years are manifesting all kinds of health problems that they couldn't have foreseen when they first started prescribing the medication.
Yes.
People are, in this country, you know, people who are, they're alive. They would have died, but they're alive.
Yes, yes.
But they are exhibiting physical breakdowns that would be more applicable to people who would be 20, 30, 40 years older than they are because of the hard things that the medication does to the body. So
yes.
People are aging
more rapidly because
right.
of the
because
medication.
Of the medication. Yeah.
If I recall, it was never presented as a cure, but it was presented as controlling the symptoms.
Right. It's prolonging of life. It's not
prolonging of life.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's not curing it. There has not. No one's come up with a cure yet.
Yes. Do you know if the medication is still prohibitively expensive, or if they brought that under control?
I really don't know the answer to that. Mm-hmm. I know that that's a huge part of the problem in other parts of the world.
Yes.
In terms of trying to get the drug companies trying to bargain collectively with the drug companies.
Yes.
Obviously, we could get into a whole discussion about
yes,
whether
could.
what is prohibitively
yes,
expensive in this country and health insurance and.
Yes, but I was recalling one of the times a number of years ago when I was in Africa. My son lives in Tanzania and has spent 20 years in Africa doing AIDS education and prevention. And I was visiting my son and his wife and talking with some of the people on his staff who live there in Dar es Salaam. And they questioned me about the so-called cure that was available to in America. And at that time, it cost $25,000 a year. And they said to me, think how many people that $25,000 could treat here, whereas in America, you spend it on one person.
Yeah.
What can you tell me about the treatment of AIDS and AIDS patients locally? I know you're active with face-to-face.
You know, Sonoma County AIDS Network, face-to-face, is one of the oldest organizations dealing with support services for people with AIDS, people living with AIDS. And they have just continued to kind of chug along over the last 30 years and grow and sort of reinvent themselves as the disease has changed and people's needs have changed. You often see them out in front of the grocery stores and the supermarkets collecting for the food bank. Helping people eat is still really important, helping people get to doctor's appointments, helping people even with the dying process, helping people sort of navigate the things that happen because of, you know, that aren't specifically about the AIDS virus in the body, but happen because people have AIDS, it is still an issue. So, you know, I mean, they basically are continuing to figure out ways to work in Sonoma County to help people. Well, they do just a lot of really good work.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a main headquarters in Santa Rosa, and there's also an office in Guerneville.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, your background is I think is might even have pointed you in the direction of this particular writing that you're doing. After San Francisco State, you went to Pacific School of Religion?
I did. I went and got a Master's of Divinity degree at Pacific School of Religion in Berkeley, which is part of the Graduate Theological Union. And then after seminary, went back to San Francisco to do arts, got a day job and did arts work before I came up to Sonoma County, and had a 12-year stint with the Sebastopol Community Church, working with children and adolescents and their families.
That's been kind of a specialty of yours, to work with young people.
Mm-hmm.
Not everybody can do it. And you've written curriculum and conducted workshops with adolescents on sexuality and spirituality. That certainly sounds challenging.
Yeah. One of the curriculums that we worked on is a comprehensive sexuality curriculum called Our Whole Lives, Sexuality and Our Faith, which got into a lot of trouble a few years ago because it's not abstinence only. Mm-hmm. It really talks about comprehensive sexuality education and really giving kids as much information as possible. And as we know, just from reading the paper in the last few months, all of those abstinence only programs didn't work so well. And that young people that do really good comprehensive sexuality education tend to make better choices about their sexual behavior, and so, but we got a lot of flack when we.
I'm sure you did.
Yeah,
that happens too frequently in this country when people take a stand that other people disagree with. They seem to get up in arms and overreact, and it makes it very uncomfortable.
Well, but it's interesting. So I do a lot of workshops around the country on teen dating violence prevention and youth and sexuality, and it's interesting, even more. What we think of, I hate to make broad generalizations, but what we think of as even more conservative churches are now talking to me about, okay, we have to deal with the fact that we do have gay and lesbian people in our congregations. Some of our teenagers are gay and lesbian. We do have teen dating violence problems. We do have teen pregnancy problems. We'd like to pretend that that doesn't happen in our community, but it does help.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you're also a playwright and a musician, and I want to give you the opportunity to talk about the concert that you're organizing that's going to take place in the next couple of days.
Yes. This will be the third annual. We've been doing a benefit for Sonoma County Habitat for Humanity. This will be the third year in a row. And an incredible array of music and musicians. It'll be on Friday, the 12th of December, 7 o'clock at the Community Church in Sebastopol. And the music is a lot of fun. It ranges from really good bluegrass, some blues, a little bit of rock and roll, good sort of standard holiday fare. The Love Choir generally sings. Mm-hmm. They're a lot of fun. And so it's a fun evening. That there's no admission. So you just come, and then about halfway through the show, we pass the plate and invite people to donate to Habitat. It's great. And usually, and again, it'll be emceed by performer, comedian Brian Wetzel.
Oh, excellent.
Who is a local treasure. We're really lucky to have him in Sonoma County.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I heard the concert last year, and I noticed that the question everyone was asking you was, what are you going to do it again?
Yeah.
So I'm delighted that we'll have a chance. And all are welcome at the Sebastopol Community Church this Friday.
Yeah, it started 3 years ago because I just felt like I wanted to, you know, channel Billie Holiday for a little while. So that's
nice. Okay, let's get to the book. I'll set it up for our listeners just a bit, because you have so carefully put this story together as a way of exploring the intrusion of the disease into a group of friends who are occupying the same apartment house, they're kind of like an extended family in the Castro district, and the way that their lives are changed by AIDS. I think that's a wonderful way to tell a story, because first of all, you present these characters and make us fall in love with them, and then you go through the various events in their lives that bring them joy and sorrow, and so we feel the emotions with them. And at the end, we come out with a feeling of, oh, that must have been what it was like to be there in those days. I think the only way you can give a message in a novel is to write superlatively, which you have done, and to create characters that engage the reader, the listener, and put them in situations that engage and that they can relate to. And I think then it just flows.
Thank you.
So let's open, as you do, with the first character who shows up, and that's Libby. She's broken her leg, and she has the most interesting thing to say about that. She says she falls a lot, and she says she actually likes the falling, the loss of control. Falling, she says, is not the trouble. It's the end of the fall. And when Libby falls down the stairs on the day after Easter and breaks her leg, she's rescued by Father Flynn from the church down the street. She calls him the beautiful Father Flynn. Would you read those two paragraphs on page 2? They reveal so much about Libby.
Yeah, she's quite a character, isn't she? The beautiful Father Flynn from the neighborhood Catholic church, St. Mary Magdalene's, turned out to be the kind soul that morning. Why are all the good ones gay, married, or priests? And whose idea was it, that celibacy thing, anyway, God, yours or the Pope's? Sometimes I sit through Mass just to watch him do that ancient dance from pulpit to altar to communion rail, the muscles of his body giving flesh to the divine. I suppose if I were Catholic, looking at him like that would have been some sort of venial sin. But right now I'm thinking I'm Buddhist by way of a Methodist childhood and a short Pentecostal adolescence. Now I periodically attend St. John's United Church of Christ with my dear friend Danny. That particular morning, Father Paul quickly surmised that I seemed to have broken my leg. It was a very good guess. As a holy man, I'm sure he has some special powers of knowledge from on high. He sprinted around the corner to St. Mary Magdalene's and called 911.
Obviously, Libby is smitten with the beautiful Father Flynn.
Indeed, she is.
And that adds a nice note of interest to the plot. You wonder what's going to happen, if anything, between the two of them. And Libby talks about my sweet Danny. She works in the candy shop that Danny owns and also is part of the household that lived there. Tell us a bit about Danny. What a lovely character.
Danny's a wonderful character. Danny was part of a Belgian chocolate-making family during World War II. Unfortunately, he was out of the country and when the Nazis moved in, and he was separated from his family. And as a result, his parents were killed. He ends up actually joining the Red Cross so that he can get back to Belgium and try and look for his family members after the war breaks out at World War II. And he ends up he does end up finding his sister, and they come back to San Francisco together. They open this small, at first it's just very small, and then it really grows and grows post-war once rationing is over and people can really indulge in chocolate again. And it grows and grows until he owns this premier candy shop, chocolate shop in the Castro district with his sister, who then eventually actually she ends up dying of breast cancer. And Libby reminds him of her. And so when Libby shows up, looking for a job, he is very tender-hearted toward her and takes her in and teaches her the chocolate business.
Mm-hmm. And she absolutely adores
him. And she loves
him. He's a father figure to her.
Yeah.
And he's not well.
Right.
And his the name of his illness, I hadn't seen this for years. I'd forgotten when it was called Kaposi sarcoma.
Right, the cancer.
A very early name for what is now just referred to as AIDS. But it was interesting to me that some of the old names for that still recur.
At the beginning, there was just such confusion about it.
Yes.
And what it was and what people were dying of. And, I mean, you know, even when people knew they had AIDS, you know, they still, you know, if you read the obituaries, they died of pneumonia. They died of cancer.
Yes.
They died of, mostly was pneumonia, a lot of pneumonia. Yeah.
Yes. I think that was presented as the cause of Danny's death, because we're not very far into the book when he has an onset of this problem. And one of the other roommates, Greg, who's a fireman, very handsome, good-looking guy, takes Danny to the hospital.
Right.
And that's one of the first times we're aware of just how ill Danny is. Now, Greg, the fireman, we'll get the cast together. We've got Libby and Father Paul and Danny. And then Greg, since he's a fireman, he has to keep the fact that he's gay. He must keep that secret.
Right. Obviously, now in San Francisco in 2008,
right.
It's okay to be, you know, a gay fireman in San Francisco. But back then, I mean, everybody was very hush-hush about their sexual orientation. And so, you know, Greg had to do the whole macho fireman thing and, you know, and pretend that he was straight.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing was part of the fear around that and part of why Greg makes a big deal about not getting tested. I mean, other characters get tested, but Greg always makes the choice not to get tested and because he's afraid that it'll leak out and then he'll get fired.
Yes. It shows that some progress has been made.
Yeah.
Yes, right. But plenty more to go. Then Greg... Greg's partner is Eddie, mm-hmm. who's a fabulous cook. Of course, Greg has to keep his relationship with Eddie very discreet because he's in fear of losing his job. But Eddie's a wonderful character. And you know, there's a lot of food in this book, a lot of cooking and eating and feasts and parties. And it does a lot to bring the situation to life and to lighten it up. As we get into it, we realize that there are going to be some deaths during this book, and we look forward to any brightness that we can find within the story. And I thought the food really worked.
Well, thank you.
Yeah
food is so important in all cultures around illness and death and celebration, and all of those things happen at that point in time.
Uh-huh. Now, the last major character is Deli, short for Delilah.
Right.
And she comes breezing in. She's the sister of Ray, who lives upstairs. And she's going to be at San Francisco State. And she's come a little early to get acquainted with San Francisco. And she's such an interesting character because she's so naive. She's from... She is naive. She's a small town girl in the big city.
And again, this is not a memoir, but I have to say I was 17 when I went off to San Francisco State, and I was from a small town. And I had people, when I wrote Deli, I had people say, this is unbelievable. She, how can she be that naive? And I just laughed because, boy, I was.
Yes. And I think many people are, but we may have forgotten just how naive we are.
Right.
And she plays a key role in so many of the important things that happen in this book simply by her innocence. And she's a charming character. She and Libby are interesting, the way you play one off against the other and emphasize their individual attributes.
Right. Libby is so emotional.
Oh, she is. She cries all the time.
She cries. She screams.
Yes.
She has a temper. She is...
She throws things.
She throws things. Yes. She does indeed. And Deli is so self-contained.
I know.
She's so self-contained.
Deli is looking at her like, can you do that?
Yeah.
Now, Deli doesn't know until she gets there that her brother Ray is gay.
Right.
But she, it doesn't seem to be a problem for her at all. And his roommate, Jack, an older fellow, turns out to be an excellent swimmer, and so is Deli.
Right.
So the two of them have swimming in common. And at some point in this book, they do the swim from Alcatraz to Aquatic Park.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, tell me about that. Is that an annual thing?
That's an annual thing. That still happens.
Oh, my gosh.
And it started right about the time that this – I mean, it started in the late 70s, early 80s. And, in fact, I have some friends here in Sonoma County that just did it a couple of years ago. And that became a real important piece of the book as Jack got sicker, mm-hmm. To be able to do that swim. And that also, of course, ties in. He'd been a champion swimmer when he was young, and his father, who is now in a care home in San mm-hmm. Francisco, has Alzheimer's. And but there's something about the swimming that seems to spark his father's. And swimming is, it's a really important image and activity for both Jack and Deli.
Yeah, and it brings them into a close friendship.
Indeed.
Yeah. And while most of the story is told alternately by Deli and by Libby, Father Paul also makes a contribution, and you put that in the form of letters to his sister, which is a wonderful novelistic technique, because we have these two women speaking in the first person, and then here is Father Paul writing the letters. And, of course, you're able to disclose some background events in these letters in a very smooth way. So whenever you need to get some information to us, Father Paul can write to his sister about it. It works beautifully.
Well, thank you.
You workshopped this novel at the University of Iowa.
Yeah, Frank Conroy didn't like that at all. He did not like the letters from Father Paul. But
how did he feel about you writing a novel with a message?
When we first got there, basically Frank said you made it into the program, which means you must be good writers, and that was the last nice thing he said to anybody for the whole session.
Yes, I've heard
it's just the way he was.
Yeah, it's a
God bless him.
Very rough program, as I understand.
Yeah, and it was a summer program, so it wasn't I wasn't there for years.
Oh, thank goodness! I'm just so admire people who can survive that. But
he was pretty. He's brutal. He was brutal.
And the people in your workshop, did they take kindly to what you were doing?
They did, yeah. A number of people really liked, particularly Libby. They really liked Libby's character.
Yes.
Again, I got a whole lot of people saying, oh, Deli's so naive. But I worked with adolescents for 25 years, and people have this image of teenagers being these wisecracking characters on television and movies, but a lot of times when kids are laughing knowingly, they really aren't. They're just laughing because everybody else is laughing. There are a lot of kids out there that are still, even today, fairly innocent.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. You're listening to A Novel Idea. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host. My guest is Lizanne Bassam, and we're talking about Lizanne's novel, One of Another, which is written about a time in San Francisco when the AIDS disease was just being identified. And the book is about a cluster of people who are affected in various ways by the onset of AIDS. Now, Danny dies fairly early in the book of what is diagnosed as pneumonia. And as the group is all together after the funeral, they're discussing how they can reach out to other people to help other people who have AIDS. They're very altruistic. And Libby and Eddie together have been feeding 50 people in the neighborhood just out of Eddie's kitchen and the chocolate shop.
Right.
So they're trying to think, how can we reach out? And Deli says, why not use the parish hall at St. Mary Magdalene's, where Father Paul is the priest? And that seems like a wonderful solution. Now, there's one thing that stands in the way. Another character, Maud Riley.
I love Maud Riley.
Oh, you can't help but love her. She's she's very outspoken. And to her way of thinking, that's not the proper use for the parish hall. And she's talking about when they have a parish meeting, she speaks right up and said, oh, you can't do that. People have to take care of their own families. My grandmother, she said, was blind, and I helped her. And so these people, their families should take care of them. And a magical moment occurs when everyone is dejected, and they thought, oh, how can we go on from here? And sweet little Deli speaks up and says to Maud Riley, what was her name?
Yeah.
Her name, whose name? She said, oh, your grandmother. Yeah. And Maud Riley's heart is just melted by Delilah's sweetness and innocence. And the hinge of the story turns there. And to no one's surprise, the parish hall becomes a place to cook for the people in the
community. And that's actually loosely based on a real story. There was the way I heard the story at First Congregational in San Francisco. There was what happened was that there was sort of the old guard who were a lot of widows, and then as the AIDS crisis heated up, a lot more men started coming to church, and so there was this old group of widows who would sit on one side of the sanctuary, and this group of younger men, single men, gay men, who would sit on the other side of the sanctuary, and during a time in the service, they would share their prayers and concerns, and they realized how much they had in common. I mean, they realized that their friends were dying around them, and that, you know, for the widows, a lot of their families had moved out of San Francisco and into the suburbs and beyond, and they were really alone, and so they were taking care of each other. And obviously for the gay men, a lot of them had moved from – many of them had moved from small towns in all over the country to San Francisco to be who they were and had lost their families when they came out. And so, you know, it actually happened. They started actually hearing each other and realizing how much they had in common and starting to work together.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And, of course, there's the traditional standoff. The health inspector shows up and says, you kids can't do this. And
right.
So then they go to school and get their certification so they could continue. That was a nice touch. When Jack dies, his family doesn't come to the funeral. And so you brought out another important aspect of what was going on with AIDS. And I suppose in many cases, it's still going on today. The refusal of the family to claim the member of the family who is gay.
You know, of course, what's interesting about that in the novel to me, and this happened a lot, and Jack, actually, his brother-in-law was a doctor. And Jack and Ray had actually gone down to New Orleans at one point. But as it really began to come out more and more, his sister and brother-in-law had two small children, and they got frightened. And they didn't even want to come to the funeral. They were afraid. They were afraid to bring their children to San Francisco. I mean, it's hard to conceive, but the level of fear, I don't know if you remember, but I mean, there was talk of, you know, sort of cordoning off quarantining whole areas of San Francisco did in Edinburgh during the Black Plague. I mean, there was some scary things going on. People were frightened and they didn't understand. Mm-hmm. And the way of dealing with it was to just, you know, quarantine people, cordon it off.
And you remember that wonderful diver in the Olympics, Greg Louganis, and he hurt himself on the board and a couple of drops of blood got in the pool. They drained the pool.
Yeah.
Or maybe that's an apocryphal rather than a true story, but it shows the level of fear.
Well, the little kids who couldn't go to school anymore.
Because
they had gotten the virus through a blood transfusion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it was just, it was crazy.
It was
so frightening.
It was a crazy
time.
And
even people who had compassion and love and were in the middle of it were terrified.
Yes. Jack's is fairly well off, and his family is not in need. And before he dies, he's thinking about Ray. And he calls them all together and says that he's decided to adopt Ray. In other words, that you point out the difficulty in a homosexual relationship of passing assets.
Right. But also any sort of end-of-life decisions.
Yes.
That gave Ray those. And that, you know, I mean, and that actually, there's an incident or there's a scene in my first novel, Barefoot, which is kind of a similar situation in somebody's dying in the hospital and the family won't let the lover of years and years and years come in. And that actually is somewhat autobiographical in that my grandmother's youngest brother was gay, and he and his partner lived in Cody, Wyoming for 30 years, if you can imagine, together, in the 1950s and 1960s. And when my great uncle was dying, because legally, they were nothing to each other. My great-grandmother was able to throw his lover of 30... I mean, this is not a new story. Everybody who you know, I mean, this is common, you know, was able to throw him out of the hospital. And he couldn't be with him as my great-uncle was dying. And that just, you know, I mean, it broke my grandmother's heart. It obviously made a real impression on me because it threads It's thread its way through two novels now.
Yes. Yes. And again, it points out the importance of permitting people to marry the people that they want to marry.
Right.
Yes.
But that, you know, that was not, I mean, there were people who were they were doing whatever they could within the legal system to create some kind of
right.
you know, legal rights to each other.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, you may think that Lizanne and I have told you the whole story of everything that happens in this book. Not so. But I think we've told you enough to pique your interest so that you'll want to read the book for yourself and find out what's happened to these lovely characters. Let's take a short break. You're listening to A Novel Idea. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host, and we'll be right back. You're listening to A Novel Idea. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host. My guest is Lizanne Bassam, and she's here to talk about her book, One of Another, which is written about San Francisco during the very early days of the AIDS epidemic. I mentioned before about writing a story with a message or a story to get a message across. You probably remember when Poisonwood Bible came out.
Oh, yeah.
And Barbara Kingsolver came to Santa Rosa and spoke. And she was asked about her commitment to social change as portrayed in her stories. The inference was that she should just write stories and not try to introduce her causes. And she said, "I believe in the power of fiction to help change the world." But again, I think it's how you tell the story. Of course, she's a compelling writer, and you want to follow her characters through all of that long novel. And the same with the characters you've created. They're so interesting, so diverse, and the plot is so interesting. We want to find out the story. What happened?
I just had somebody stop me in the street the other day and say, "I just finished it. When's the sequel coming out? I want to know what happened."
That's a question I was going to ask you. When is will there be a sequel?
Oh, I don't know. We'll see. I have never sat down planning to write something except for curriculum that someone has commissioned me to do. So I don't know. But
Well, you may find that that Deli is nudging you and saying, "What about me? I'm still around." And that would be nice.
It would be interesting to know.
Yeah,
what happened to them 20 years later?
Well, if you find out and decide to do it,
okay.
We'll be waiting.
I'll let you know.
Yeah. I think in order to get the message across, the story has to go from the personal to the universal. I mean, the writer is saying, this is what happened to these people. When it's a biography or a memoir, the writer is saying, this is what happened to me. But unless they can tap in to a universal feeling so that the reader, even though it hasn't happened to the reader can empathize. And I think that's what we strive for in writing when we want to get a message across. Would you agree?
Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, the reality of you know, I mean, this novel, you know, people are dying of AIDS.
Yes.
But, you know, the reality is that we all have had family members and friends die of something out of time. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, for them, it's dealing with the fact that it's AIDS and it has that whole overlay and all of the social issues that went along with that, certainly in the 80s. But the reality is that everyone knows what it's like to lose someone you love. And so you can be sympathetic and empathetic with these characters. Yes. Mm-hmm. Because they have created their own family.
Yes, yes, they truly have a lovely extended family among themselves.
Right.
And also the way you bring humor into the story lightens it. And that's welcome. I mean, as we know, it's going to be a story about some of these characters are going to die. But the funny things that happen give us a break. Well, as we go along, and that's always welcome. I also like the very specific details of the time. There's a new game, Trivial Pursuit. Well, that pins it exactly in history, because I think most of us who are old enough to remember, yeah, Trivial Pursuit remember when it first came on the scene, and we became experts in all these esoteric fields so that we could play that.
Right.
So there are a lot of touches like that of,
yeah,
things that were special to,
yeah,
that,
yeah,
moment.
You don't have to have lived in San Francisco I to get a flavor of it, but if you did live in San Francisco at any point, and there, you know, in the neighborhoods, there's so many different neighborhoods in San Francisco that have such their own character. And so I've had several people who lived in San Francisco at one point or other in their life and just said, oh, it's so fun to go revisit and go,
yes,
back to the neighborhoods, because, yes, they live in the Castro, but there are things that happen in the Haight,
yes,
and there are things that happen in, you know, different parts of the,
yes,
city. And,
yes,
so,
and people who love San Francisco love San Francisco stories.
<That's>
and
true.
The more specific, the better. You know, you talk about the Palace Hotel, and I'm sure that many of our – is that the – yeah, the Palace.
Yeah, the Sheraton Palace.
Yes. And I'm sure many of the readers have been there.
Yeah.
And so as soon as you set the scene there, they can just feel what that was like.
Yeah.
And that's a good writing about the locale. The location is almost a character in the story.
Indeed.
Uh-huh. Another way of getting a message across is the protest novel, which is a little sharper, a little darker, and a little more hard-hitting. You and I both read a protest novel about the AIDS time in San Francisco called A Day in San Francisco by Dorothy Bryant. And I ask you to read it so that you and I could talk about the difference between a message novel and a protest novel. It's a story about a woman from Northern California who teaches in a small college. She has a son who's gay who lives in San Francisco. She's totally cool with that. She's always been a very liberal person. And she wants to go to the Day of Protest March with her son. So she's down in San Francisco trying to reach him by phone while the parade is going on. And she's really offended by the way that some of the gay people present themselves in the parade. And her thought is, she's always been a rebel, and she's thinking, did I go through all the years of protest for this? And she's finds that her son is ill. There's a lot of sadness and personal tragedy in the book. But it was a very different way to present the material.
They're both about pain and death, but I found hers difficult at times to,
yes,
read, but I lived there, and,
yes,
I, you know, I mean, she nailed it. She presented a lot of things that weren't pretty,
yes,
that were very difficult and,
yes,
painful. And, you know, I mean, I remember that.
Yes.
I remember that time, and I remember that there's a scene, it's the Gay Freedom Day Parade,
yes,
and then they end up at a big benefit at the Castro Theater, and there's a male drag queen who,
yes,
is just being really obnoxious,
yes,
in terms of making fun of women.
Yes.
And so this whole contingent of lesbians, you know, get up and storm out.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, I remember, I remember being in San Francisco, sort of in the sort of infighting and really struggle with trying to come together to say, look, we're human beings, we need rights. But there was a lot of anger and back and forth between the gay male community and the lesbian community, particularly. And then you get into the whole thing around, sort of white gay lesbian folks,
yes,
and gay lesbian folks of color. And
yes,
it just layers and layers and very complicated. And she, you know, I mean, she just sort of warts and all. I mean, that her novel really pulls that out, and a lot of the, you know, it wasn't just AIDS. The precursor to AIDS was everybody was getting hepatitis, and just you know, incredible myriad of different STDs.
Yeah.
And she's, you know, the way she writes about it, it's very raw.
She presented it with such reality that I felt like I was there watching that parade.
It's very stark.
Very stark. And of course, her concept of the self-indulgence of these people who were acting out their fantasies and enjoying being rude and that sort of thing really turned her off, because she was her idea of being a revolutionary was something a little different.
Which is funny if you think about it. Again, I worked with adolescents for 25 years, and before AIDS, there was a period of time, sort of post-sexual revolution, pre-AIDS. And it had nothing to do with your sexual orientation, but there was a level of freedom around just sleeping around with lots of people, both gay and straight, that was happening at that time. In her novel, she's really focusing on the gay population.
Yes, that's right. I hadn't thought of that.
But that was going on college campuses all over the place, gay and straight. Once AIDS hit in the way it hit, things did change.
Yes. Yes.
But there was this sort of window of time, sort of post the pill and pre-AIDS, when kind of all bets were off.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
And Dorothy Bryant took a tremendous amount of criticism from the gay community for her rather stark portrayal of them, particularly the things that happened that day. And there was a call for censorship of the book. There was a call to ban the book. And it's some of that controversy is still around. I looked on her website to see, you know, what it said there now about the controversy. And I'll just read a bit of that to you. What happens when a writer publishes a truth that some readers would prefer not to acknowledge? If reaction grows and spreads, it may become strong enough to constitute a sort of unofficial censorship. Those who want to suppress the book may combine distortion, misrepresentation, and name-calling to persuade readers to condemn the author and refuse to read the book. Bryant discusses six famous authors: Ivan Turgenev, Thomas Hardy, George Orwell, Hannah Arendt, William Styron, who suffered such attacks by literary lynch mobs, her quotes. She concludes with a memoir of similar attacks on her novel, A Day in San Francisco. It was a tremendous flap when her book was published, and it's it happens. I mean, people react in bad ways and attack the author instead of looking at their own behavior.
Well, and you have to, you know, I mean, the gay lesbian community is certainly not monolithic, and so.
Oh, absolutely. I was thinking about some of the early writings about AIDS. Do you remember a play called The Normal Heart by Larry Kramer? I remember seeing that at Yale Rep a long, long time ago. I thought it wasn't a particularly good play, but I thought it was important. And the fact that there was a play about AIDS, to me, that was the important part about it. Not that it was a great play or a good play, but it was being presented, and I think it was presented pretty widely, probably in the small repertory companies. I don't think it ever got a big production. But then we had Angels in America, which
Huge.
You have to call a big production.
Right.
And of course, it was that's very recent, so that a number of years had passed between the two of them.
Right.
Can you think of other things, either plays or novels?
Well, the band, you know, and the band,
well, the band played
on, which
of course.
Is in some ways, I don't want to say the definitive, but, you know, I mean, it lays it out.
Yeah, Randy Schultz, right?
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Just lays it out,
yes.
And
more history,
right?
Of the
movement. but there's humanity in it too. It isn't just facts and figures,
not just the story.
And that's really an amazing work,
right?
Yeah,
and I wanted to include some other writers who have addressed the issue of writing fiction about social change that I felt got this across, and then I'll see what you want to add to my
okay.
list. one of the first things that came to me was George Orwell, Homage to Catalonia. And I think that's regarded as one of the classic anti-war stories because, first of all, well, he was there, and he's such a skilled writer, and he revealed so much about his own feelings. And I think people will be reading that for a long time. Nadine Gordimer in South Africa is a very important writer to me. That she's been, over the years, she's been just steadfast in presenting the opposition view to apartheid while it was going on. And she has a very interesting book that I like so much. It's called Writing and Being. And in many ways, it's about how you do it, how she does it, how you propose the things that are important to you and incorporate them into your writing so that people will read them and think about them. I'll just read you a bit from the book jacket. Gordimer shows how the struggle is contrastingly expressed in factual accounts and lyrical poetry. Gordimer turns to three writers linked by their search for a life that transcends their own time and place. In distinctive and telling ways, Naguib Mahfouz, Chinua Achebe, and Amos Oz defy accepted terms of loyalty to the mores and politics of their countries. Their search in Egypt, Nigeria, and Israel for a meaningful definition of home testifies to what it must be, the destination of the human spirit beyond national boundaries. And then ending on a personal note, Gordimer reveals her own experience of writing her way out the confines of a dying colonialism. It's quite a wonderful book. And I like her novel, July's People, particularly to present the dilemmas of that time in South Africa before apartheid was set aside. What would you add to my list?
I there are a lot of people that it isn't obvious that they're writing. But, mm-hmm. If you read Isabel Allende, what is it, House of Spirits?
Oh, yes.
It isn't about what was going on politically in South America and Central America and sort of U.S. policies, but you know by the end of the book. I mean, you get it. For me, it's important what I enjoy reading.
Yes.
Is about human beings and their relationships and the larger complex political and social justice issues that come into play just because of humanity. And so writers that don't hit you over the head with it, but it can't help but be there depending on where the novel is set, what's going on in the larger world. Those are the novels that I like. And again, sort of Isabel Allende.
Oh, yes.
Does that, I think, quite well. Certainly, Barbara Kingsolver does that quite well, too. A couple of her novels get a little heavy-handed, mm-hmm. but for the most part, they're not.
That's right.
But you come away really knowing things mm-hmm. about certain kinds of injustice.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And Gretel Ehrlich, Terry Tempest Williams, there are so many. Yeah. And the writing about the environment these days is mm-hmm. also exhilarating.
Even Ann Patchett.
Yes.
Again, right. Her stuff is not explicitly about social justice issues,
right.
But it's in there.
Oh, that's right.
And people struggle with all kinds of things. And
you just can't forget that moment in Bel Canto when these people suddenly realize that they're hostages.
Yeah.
I know. People are really skillful these days in telling these wonderful stories to us that make us think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Bel Canto has got to be one of my favorite novels of all time.
Oh, me too.
I love Bel Canto.
Me too.
Yeah.
Right. And, of course, a good book is even better on the second, third, and fourth reading.
That's true.
That's my tip. Well, Lizanne, it's been such a joy to talk with you this afternoon. My guest is Lizanne Bassam, the author of One of Another. And I do thank you for joining me to talk about your book and also to discuss the challenges of writing a novel that carries a message.
Rosemary, thank you for having me on, and I really appreciate the work that you do here, and certainly just the whole radio station and what you all do in our community.
Wonderful.
Very
radio
important.
Station.
Very important.
This is a good time to toss a bouquet to Suzanne Lang, who produces the show. We have a couple of minutes left. Why don't we bring Suzanne into the conversation? Suzanne, do you want to talk a bit about upcoming shows?
Well, yeah, I think I can do that. In January, we will do a show with Frances Thinkelspiel, who you just had the pleasure of talking to the other day. Mm-hmm. And that book is called
Towers of Gold. It's a wonder. It's a biography of her great-great-grandfather, a man who was very important in the early history of California and seems to have been completely forgotten. He's just fallen off the charts. And Frances has brought him back and written a wonderful book about his life and the importance that he played in the formation of what we call California.
Yes, and in fact, the book is called, if I'm not mistaken, Towers of Gold, How One Jewish Immigrant Named
Isaiah Hellman
created California.
California.
Yes.
Now, is that a provocative title or what? And Frances is very, very good. You're going to enjoy that conversation a lot.
So that's in January. Mm-hmm. And then we've just had the pleasure of working with Sherry Reynolds, who is a Southern writer, if I might call her that. And her latest book is...
The Sweet in Between.
It's
her fifth novel. And she's an absolute delight. And one of the things that's very, very special about her is that one of her books was selected for Oprah's book club. And she's going to tell the story of that on the air. And it's a Cinderella story. You're going to love Sherry Reynolds.
Yes, she was, I think, Oprah's sixth book back in maybe 1997, something like that, when Oprah Winfrey was first starting that book club. So that will be our February show. And so we have a lot of good things lined up for the new year.
Oh, and we have some interesting things. And yeah. It's amazing, isn't it?
We have some good things lined up for the coming year. And I want to wish you and our listeners a very joyous winter holidays this year. And this is the time when we normally think of buying gifts for people. And what better thing to do than books?
Books. And I hope all of you get lots of books for gifts and get the ones that you want. And there's nothing like the pleasure of giving people books.
Yeah, and maybe a good way to give books this year is to pry something out of your own collection. And that's certainly inexpensive. And what a lovely gesture to share a book from your own collection and swap books that you've enjoyed reading.
That's a great idea. Let's do that. So we wish you all the best for the holidays, and we'll see you in the new year.
See you in the new year.
And remember, there is no such thing as too many books.